You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
She called the police and she said, "Are you really beating your mothers, brothers, sisters, fathers, and friends? Is this who you are? Shame on you. Shame on you." Then she hung up.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Born in communist Czechoslovakia, Ava has written an honest and unflinching account of her childhood in Bratislava. Ava's parents were Catholics, and the communist regime began to persecute the Catholic Church right from the start in 1948. They had to hide their faith from anyone outside their home. Ava provides us with an insightful and emotional conversation that captures her experiences of life in communist Czechoslovakia and the resulting trauma. Do check out her book, Forgiveness and Violets, which is available via any good bookstore. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a written review in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. By telling your friends, you can really help us get new guests on the show. And if you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too, plus you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a monthly supporter of the podcast, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Ava to our Cold War conversation.
I was born 1976 during communist Czechoslovakia in November, and life was very different back then. So we lived very modestly, and I grew up in Bratislava. Today it's the capital of Slovakia. Back then it was Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia. And I grew up with my sister and my parents in a small flat in the periphery of Bratislava, so not in the center. It was four of us in a two-bedroom flat.
Okay. And what did your parents do for employment?
So my parents were always very intelligent, which was good, but also quite difficult because it was always about achieving and learning. And we hardly ever had simple conversations about just the weather or something. So my mom studied economy. She was an economist and later in life also a human resource director at a company. And my father, so my mom unfortunately passed away last year. So this is why I will speak in the past tense, past form. My father is a very intelligent man who studied first mechanical engineering, and then he also studied everything about metals, metallurgy. So he also lectured for a short time at a tech university in Bratislava before he moved to work in the private sector, yeah. Today's private sector, so construction.
Yeah, and those sort of jobs, did they pay well?
During communism, the situation was different. The difference between the pay a person in office job received wasn't that much more than somebody who was a worker, and that was part of the concept of equality, which was really weird, because when you invest time into studies and you have a brain that can help to construct buildings and bridges, why do you end up being paid the same as somebody who digs, I don't know, holes next to the road, you know? Mm. So, yeah, it felt a bit unjust, I would say, because we were poor. We were poor. Both parents were studied. They worked very hard, and we were poor. And the poverty you could feel looking at us, the clothes were very modest, usually clothes previously worn by somebody else, clothes we were given. And it was the food. It was very simple food. Back then, we didn't have meat every day. I mean, today I don't eat meat anymore. But back then, it was a sign of poverty when you had all the time like potatoes and you had chicken once per week on a Sunday. So the life was very modest, I would say.
But I understand your parents also were very religious as well.
Yes, they were. They were. So I grew up in a conservative Catholic family where life was about discipline and working, and you didn't just receive things, you had to earn them. So it wasn't like me asking for something, you know, like a sweater. I wanted a new sweater, a better sweater than I had, but I couldn't just ask for it. And it wasn't just the poverty, it was everything. We had to behave, we had to study, we had to have good grades at school, and then we were allowed to receive things. And watching TV wasn't an everyday thing for us. I have to say that. We had to earn it. I couldn't come straight after school and just start watching TV, binge watch sitcoms or something. No way. It was after school, it was learning. Then it was also creative playing, mm-hmm. where we were encouraged to learn new things through games and play. And then in the evening, it was half an hour, when we were lucky, half an hour of TV. So it wasn't a regular thing, and it wasn't like watching TV for hours. I read so many books, and not just books we had to for the school. I loved to read books. I love to read books to this day. I read hundreds and hundreds of books in my life.
And that must have been quite difficult for your parents, having that faith in a country where being religious was frowned upon at that time.
Yes. So to mention more about the Christianity or the Catholic, being Catholic during a totalitarian regime, I felt like there are two worlds within one. One world was at home, the four walls. There was a different atmosphere and different communication where my parents shared information about saints. For example, Saint Francis of Assisi. We learned basics about the Catholic faith, my sister and I. But at the school, it was all about the communism and the leaders and glorifying those leaders with everything, you know. So it was all present, and And with that, I mean, not just photographs on the walls with Lenin, Stalin, and other guys, you know, but also the subject we had at schools, the civics lessons, and then the Russian. I learned Russian since the age of 8. Can you imagine?
Wow.
So, and we didn't just learn some facts about Lenin or Stalin. It was singing songs, like songs to glorify them. And then I came home and it was learning the Ten Commandments and other things. So I was, that was really confusing, really yeah. confusing. And my parents were really worried. So they didn't share as much as they wanted. And what they shared, they told us not to speak about it. Because it was better, it was much better to be invisible during a regime than to be noticed because of being different. It's you were always risking when you were different.
Yeah, so you were warned not to talk about your religion at school.
Of course, yes.
Your parents, what were they like to you and your sister?
They were very strict. So I think it was a combination of several factors. It was the way they grew up, the ways they experienced, including discipline and learning and not having, you know, just potatoes and basic food. And I have to mention physical punishments. So this is what they experienced, the lack of material goods, the hard life, the lack of variety and certain cold, particularly my mother, where there was like real poverty and hunger and lack of physical closeness. And unfortunately, it was a bit similar when I grew up, where there was a lack of physical closeness, and I missed that, you know. And the more I met my friends and I visited them, the more I saw that there were some things missing in our family. But at the same time, I saw and I witnessed how stressed my parents were because they just couldn't be themselves, really. They refused to join the Communist Party. It was a big thing, you know, when you don't go with the flow, you know, and particularly when you are like my father, an academic, you know, they were really pressurizing him, but he didn't. They had many discussions at home. And I was little, but I understood some of the things they were discussing. They were really, and you felt the energy. As a child, you feel the energy, the stress, the tension. And I think, so this is where I said it's several factors contributing to this cult, certain cult, and strict upbringing that actually brought me and my sister closer together. So we already early in life, we were very, very close and we were playing together and a little bit fighting for the food like siblings do. But we were very close. We were hugging each other, crying together, playing together. Yeah, I love her very much. We have a really good relationship to this day.
And that comes across in your book. And the book is lovely with some of the stories and the sort of scenes that you paint in the book. I found really, really moving because you sort of are hungry for affection. And you find that with one set of your grandparents, don't you?
Well, thank you very much for saying that, Ian. I appreciate that you like my book. My grandparents were very different. So, as I said, my mom had it very difficult as a child. So, because her parents were very poor, and so my grandparents, my maternal maternal grandparents, they were very poor. And I spent there one summer with my sister, and it was, I understood more why my mom is the way or was the way she was. It was this poverty and this hard work. And my mom was the oldest of five children. And she had to take care, or she took care of the four younger siblings. And by the time my sister and I were born, we spent time with the grandparents, they were exhausted. It was a lot for them. They were poor. They had a difficult life, and this was just two more children they had to take care of. So for them, it was, they just went to work on the field, or we cooked together, but there was not real closeness. And looking at my grandma's hands, they were so damaged, and it was so painful to see. So although my maternal grandparents were rather cold, I didn't judge them, because I saw and I understood their struggle to a certain extent already as a child. When you see people so poor and so hardworking and with damaged hands, with so many blisters. But I spent more summers with my paternal grandparents, so with my father's parents, and they were very loving, very, very. My sister and I, we were always looking forward to spend time with them, because my grandfather, he even got us, I would say one was newer and one was repaired, bicycles. So he organized bicycles for us so we can have some adventures in the small town in Slovakia, Czechoslovakia at that time. They were very loving with each other. And it was so nice to see, because the way they spoke, the way they smiled at each other, and this daily affection. And although they didn't have it easy either, because my great-grandmother, she lived with them. So they raised three sons. One of them is my father. And they had the great-grandmother with them, so my father's grandmother with them, since she was in her 30s, I think, late 30s, because her husband died of an illness. So they had it difficult, because they lived like three generations together. But it was my grandfather who was very loving, but also very understanding, and understanding when to leave. He was very good at that. So he wasn't weak in avoiding confrontation or arguments. But he was, this needs now space. So he said always mama. So he called his mother in law. He called her mama, and he said, Maminko, I'm not going to quarrel, argue about that. So do as you feel is good. And then he just got up and went to work in the garden. So also the reactions, there was this maturity and this love and respect. I really liked that. So it was my grandparents, but also my great-grandmother, whom I experienced until the age of 14, I think, 14 or 15 when she died. So actually quite a lot. And I used to steal, I'm laughing when I'm saying that always. I used to steal her lozenges. So she was always having some lozenges under the pillow. And me and my sister, we loved those lozenges. And she bought always new. And then when she opened the little box, she had like two left. So she was a very interesting woman. I have to mention her because she was very energetic. She died when she was over 90, and until the last 6 months of her life, She was like cooking every day, going to church every day. She had strong opinions about everything. She was a very strong woman, but also not easy to deal with. This is where I'm saying my grandfather was great that he could, yeah, manage to live in that environment with.
Yeah. No, it's that you have some lovely stories about your grandparents and various adventures round at their place, where they do display quite a level of forgiveness. I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, that's true.
in your book, I mean, it's great because it does give me a really rich picture of somebody's childhood in Czechoslovakia. And you talk about some of the childhood games that you played as well. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Of course. The games were rather simple because there were not so many toys. Like today, you know, you enter the shop and everything, you get everything instantly, you know. So even the toys you had to wait to get them, you know. It was usually Christmas or birthday where you received something. So it wasn't like receiving toys regularly. Funny enough, one of the most popular toys during Czechoslovakia was a toy, I think, with Japanese origin. It was called Monchichi. Monchichi, and it was like a small, hairy monkey. It was either gray or brown. And it was very interesting because I have a French friend and I gave him my book as a present and he read it. And then he asked me, so how come that you know about Monchichi? I used to play with my Monchichi and I grew up in southern France. So I find this story very interesting because it's a different part of Europe and he played with Monchichi when he was a child. So my sister and I, we played with Monchichi. We had our dolls and our books, but we were also very creative in finding our own ways to play. So for example, we used sand. We used buckets of sand, and we had five different buckets of sand, and we pretended that this is a shop, an ice cream shop. And my sister was the shop assistant selling the ice cream and I was the customer. So she mixed the sand with leaves or sand with nutshells or sand with some newspaper bits. And every type of mixture represented a different ice cream. And then I came with my bucket and I asked her to give me always a spoonful, was like, you know, one portion. And we collected a particular size of stones, right, small red stones, and they were the currency. So we were quite creative in having our own games. Yeah. But saying that, I also have to say that some of our games were a mixture of play and what we observed or what we watched on the TV but didn't really understand what is it about. So I'm saying that because we had a game where we played partisans, you know, partisans and I don't know, I can't even like remember totally, but Nazis and partisans and locals. And we were in at the playground with some, there were some trees and we were hiding and then building a bunker. And we were like three girls and two boys. And so it was not just my sister and I. And we were playing those weird games where one party was defending the bunker with the leaves and with the branches. And then they came so one were partisans and then were the bad ones. Partisans were the good ones because during communism, they were the ones in 1944 fighting the Nazis.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, we play. Yeah. I mean, that's very similar to my childhood experience of playing those sort of games where it was the British against the Germans and You know, and on TV in the UK in the 1970s, there was a steady diet of war films from, you know, based on stories around World War II.
So did you watch them?
Yes.
As a child?
Yeah, and they made quite a big impact on me because my father had fought in World War II. So he'd had direct experience. Okay. But it's amazing. I mean, if you Google some of this stuff, you can still, I mean, that's what's quite nice about the internet is you can revisit your childhood to some degree. Because I presume, have you tried Googling that monkey toy at all?
Of course. I have a photo of that, yeah.
You know, that's one of the nice things is you can sort of revisit these long forgotten items from your childhood and see them again. And even the TV programs that were on. As well, you can see those. I mean, were there many programs aimed at kids on Czechoslovak TV?
The Evening Fairy Tale was very nice, I have to say, because there was a particular jingle. You say jingle, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
the sound,
yeah.
Always like inviting the children to join. And the jingle was really beautiful with an animation of a grandpa who came out of the house followed by a dog. So already the jingle was so beautiful before the fairy tale. So this half an hour, I don't know how long that was. It was really pretty. And we were every day looking forward to that jingle of that grandpa leaving that house and with the dog and with a magic wand and then... touching the sky with the magic wand, and then the stars appeared. So it was very sweet. And then we had some fairy tales. There were other like own production like of Czechoslovakia or like Soviet, you know,
yeah.
like the wolf. It's called in Russian Nupagadi. It was very famous during communism. This.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Wolf who is chasing the rabbit. You know, it's like Tom and Jerry, but we had...
Right, Tom and Jerry Soviet style.
Yeah, exactly. But it was actually really funny.
Yeah.
I have to say it was good. It wasn't rubbish. It was really very funny with the wolf and with the rabbit. So
yeah.
It was called Nupagadi. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll have to see if I can find some of that on YouTube. That sounds good.
Oh, I can
good.
Send that to you then later. Yeah.
With school, can you remember your first day at school?
Only blurred, so not so clearly. But I remember it. There were tears.
Yeah.
So I was tearful. Like, but you know, my parents were strict. It was my mom, and my mom, it was just, she just had to look at me, and I knew I have to stop the tears. So
right.
I stopped the tears, and I was just like, I knew that I have to go inside and behave and do my best. And then in the evening, she will pick me up. And I wasn't the youngest because I was born in November. So I went to school 1 year later. So they didn't put me into school earlier, but later. So I wasn't the youngest there, but yeah, it wasn't a good feeling. So
no.
I remember that I didn't like it that much because it was strange to be away from my parents and my sister. But yeah, I think most of the children aren't excited the first day at school, are they?
What was your favorite subject at school?
That's a good question. To tell you, although the first day wasn't that nice, I really liked the school because I liked to learn new things. And I have to say, I love to learn to this day. So it's like a lifelong learning. And I think that was the good thing and is the good thing about my parents, that to never stop questioning, to never stop learning, to always try to explore. Looking back at school, the primary school, I like nearly everything apart from the civics. I didn't like civics because it was like, as I said, Lenin, Stalin, and so on. But I loved everything else. I liked mathematics. I liked literature, languages. I liked geography. I really love to learn all the countries and their capitals and the rivers. And I couldn't get enough. You know, so I really loved to learn, and it was my mom who noticed early in life that I really like languages. So my father first tried to teach me guitar, but that didn't work at all. So he was a bit disappointed because he's a good guitar player, or he was, he doesn't play now anymore. But he was even in a band they played. At like student events and so on. So my father didn't succeed. He won't be happy to hear that now. But yeah, that's a fact that he tried, but he saw that I can't focus and I didn't have the passion. So it was my mom who noticed early that I really like to recite and I repeat words. I hear something on TV and I repeated it. So I was 6 years old. Can you imagine? I wasn't in the school yet. And my mom said to my father, let's try German. So I attended my first language course at the age of 6. And that was great. I loved it. I was walking around the flat. And then we had also a garden, which is a very important part of my childhood. So I was walking either in the flat or in the garden, and I was reciting. I was reciting poems, singing songs, and then in German when I was 6. Wow. And then I was 8 when I was chosen for the class of excellence because of my intelligence, and I started to learn Russian. So by the age of 10, I spoke already 3 languages. So my Slovak, my native, German, Russian, and German by the age of 10, 12.
Wow. Yes. Wow, that's an incredible feat. I struggle to speak English, let alone another language like that. And, you know, with my parents, I think they were always keen to keep learning. And although my parents never went to university or did any, you know, higher education, they were always interested in reading and particularly history. And that's where I sort of get my passion for history from, is from them always with their nose in some sort of history book, both of them, and, you know, wanting to visit countries and see places. And geography, I'm with you there. I used to love looking at maps and seeing the rivers and the cities and the oceans, but maths, that's where I leave you, because that has never been a subject that I've particularly enjoyed.
I think it's quite obvious that you like history and geography. I mean, Cold War Conversations, your podcast, is about knowledge and knowledge sharing and sharing experience. So it's quite obvious that you like knowledge. You like knowledge and you like to also share.
Yeah, knowledge. Well, thank you. But I like your story about the blue jeans.
So there is first a story about this story. And one day I was a bit frustrated because I started to write short stories and it was a passion. So the stories I didn't write them in that order. So I wrote different short stories and then after some time, I realized I have enough for a book. But the blue jeans story, I was frustrated because one day I just wrote one sentence. And I went to bed the next day, I read the sentence, and I realized this is a great sentence. Why are you disappointed? You know, we always think everything is about quantity. And I was first disappointed because I wrote only one sentence that day. But then when you read the book, it's the main sentence, and I will read it for you. When I was a child, I dreamed of owning a pair of blue jeans. And the story is about me dreaming of having jeans and maybe even feel a bit more Western, because I saw the jeans on the TV, and that was something I never had. So the clothes we wore, my sister and I, were clothes we received from our relatives, and also clothes my father so creatively produced for us, because he learned it so we can have new clothes. The blue jeans story is about my sister and I not having the jeans, and particularly me wanting the jeans, and just seeing other people having them and dreaming of, as we usually do, to dream of something that we don't have, and then finally getting them at, I think, at the age of 13, where my auntie gave me a bag of all the clothes she didn't wear anymore, and there were jeans. There were jeans, and they were huge, and I had to use a belt so I could wear them so they don't fall down. So I was happy. So that was my childhood, you know, not having and dreaming and having itchy clothes. So many of the clothes we wore were like, I don't know what it was, polyester, but very, yeah, you sweat a lot and the jeans, yeah, were a symbol of freedom, of something I really liked, because yeah, from the TV, what I watched, for example, King Kong, the older version of King Kong, and so I had some idea how the Western streets, the streets of the West, look like. Although, of course, it was just a movie, and you know.
Yeah, and it was from the 1930s as well, I think, that version, that black and white film. I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, being Slovak, I mean, Alexander Dubček was Slovakian, wasn't he? Yeah. Did your parents sympathize with Dubček? I know it's before you were born, but did they talk about the Prague Spring?
Oh, they mentioned him. Yeah. And then of course later in life, so not so much during my childhood, because it was, as I said, the atmosphere of fear and tension and everything. But of course they did, you know. So Dubček was very valued, and Dubček he brought hope. Yeah, but then 1968 happened. You know, the invasion of the Soviets with the members of the Warsaw Pact. So that changed everything, and it got really bad.
One of the many stories that I like in, and we're not going to go through the whole book tonight. But there was a nice story, but an interesting one about a photo that you stuck in your school book that didn't go down too well with your teachers.
Yes, you remember that correctly. So, as I mentioned, civics wasn't my favorite subject at school, because civics was about the communist leaders and their lives, and we had to learn so many dates, when they were born, when they went to school, when they became member of the Communist Party, that level, then top leader, you know, and it was a lot. And
I'm gonna be testing you on those dates in a moment. So I hope you've remembered them all.
I hope, because
don't worry. Sorry, I interrupted your
No, story. It was very funny. I successfully forgot everything, and I suppressed everything that wasn't good for me. So we have to, have to say, at some point we have to enter a journey of healing. And this is a part I completely left behind me. But the story with my notepad, where I wrote the notes during the civics lesson. So within a couple of months, we had to choose a photo for the first page we left blank, a photo of a communist leader we look up to, we admire. And the time came where the teacher was urging us to find a photo in the newspapers and fill the blank page and then write about that leader a couple of lines. And I found a photo of Bush Senior. So I chose Bush for my notepad, and I it was there on the first page, and as soon as my teacher saw it, she became very, very angry, very angry. And I had to get up. I was lectured, it was very, very unpleasant. And in front of everyone, she destroyed, destroyed the notepad. And I had to rewrite all the things from, I couldn't really use the destroyed notepad. So I had to use my fellow pupils' notepad to rewrite everything into a new one. And then I was told to choose wisely again. So to choose the second photo now wisely. So then I just had Brezhnev. I had Brezhnev there. So it's like, I can't. Is there anyone worse than that, than Brezhnev or Benesh? It's like,
Yeah.
So I had Brezhnev then in my notepad, and I was silent and conform.
And did your parents get called in over that?
No, because they thought that I'm just stupid, that I didn't do it on purpose, that I was just like stupid.
You thought you'd found a photo of some obscure party leader in Moravia or somewhere.
Yeah, so they thought they just, I had no idea who it is, because I didn't write into the notepad like article about why I like Bush or the Western world, but it was just like.
You just saw it was some politician and just stick that in.
Yeah, just to complete the task, to stick a face from the newspaper and everyone in the newspaper.
Yeah, brilliant.
But it's,
Brilliant. And presumably you had to join the Young Pioneers as well.
Yes. So that was pleasant and unpleasant. And I share both parts. So before you became a pioneer, you were actually a spark. Was like a preface, because when you are like 6, 7 years old, you are not a pioneer yet, but you are a hot candidate to become one. So you're first a spark. So before you become the member of the Communist Party, you are brainwashed, since the age of 6. Yeah. So first you are a spark, and then you become a pioneer, and you have to swear. You have to swear, and this is a huge thing, or this was a huge thing, because we actually went in Bratislava to a particular place where the all the Soviet soldiers who liberated, the Nazi satellite state Slovakia.
Yeah.
This is how we were seen during the Second World War, from 1939 to 45, with a Catholic priest as president. So, when we were liberated, you see the quotation, my fingers quotation marks, by the Soviets, only to have another totalitarian oppressive regime. So the Soviet soldiers were buried in Bratislava. They are buried. It's called, the place is called Slavin, and that's to this day there, and there are all the soldiers buried, and we students, pupils, had to all go there, and it was a huge assembly, and we had to swear. We were given scarves, and like that, this was a huge ceremony where we had to repeat, and the vow, or the what we had, what we had to swear. This was a long vow. It's in the book. I'm not going to say it now, but it was long, and it was. I had to say that I'm going to defend my homeland, and I'm always ready to defend my homeland, you know, and give my life for my homeland. I was thinking like, what? You know, it made no sense. But on the other hand, as a child, you want to belong. You have this longing to belong. And I had fellow friends who were pioneers. Everyone was a pioneer. So there wasn't like, you are pioneer and you are not. Everyone was a pioneer. And so the negative side were all these ceremonies and what we had to swear and what we had to learn. And then we had to wear this uniform where we sweat during the summer, during the assemblies, and we had to hold our hand a certain way to greet, you know. But the good side of being a pioneer were the summer camps. The summer camps with fellow pioneers were wonderful because we learned a lot about the nature. So I experienced at least three pioneer camps where I learned how to survive in a forest. So there was always this, you know, this being strong, being a soldier, being strong for your homeland. But as a child, you want to know everything about every tree and leaf and animal and what to eat and what to not to eat in a forest. And it was exciting, and how to produce a fire with nothing, you know, with the stones. We did that. And I think the funniest thing I consider today, I learned as a child, as a 10-year-old child, was I learned the Morse code. I learned the Morse code, and I knew how to use the Morse code because there were many children who didn't get it or they forgot it, but I remembered it, and there was another pupil at the summer camp who also remembered, so we exchanged notes in the Morse code, and then the other tried to snatch it, but they were too lazy to decode it. So we were two girls who were using Morse code to exchange secret notes about boys and whatever. It was
brilliant.
Yeah, it was great.
That sounds amazing. It sounds like they were preparing you to be partisans.
yeah, soldiers fighting for the homeland and yeah.
As we get towards 1988 and 1989, I believe your father was involved in a demonstration in Bratislava in 1988. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, I remember it. I remember that day. It was in March 1988, and it was one of the first, if not the first, demonstration in Bratislava. It was called, and it is called to this day, for those who are interested, the candle demonstration, 1988, where people gathered just holding a candle and a silent like a silent demonstration, but they were also somewhere praying or singing like quietly. But it was very peaceful, and it was organized by religious leaders, you know, who were hiding more or less. But it was by the Catholic Church and by people who were believers and who couldn't express themselves because they were oppressed, like my parents, you know, they could not really express themselves, say who they are. And so it was a very peaceful demonstration and so for human rights and for freedom of religion. It turned very violent in the sense of there were police officers and officers from the secret body, STB, Staatsbezirksnost. So there were police officers and Estebazi, how we called them. And they started to beat people because they didn't leave. So they were there, standing there. And the story my father told me, and after years, is that he was standing there and he didn't have a candle. He just left early at the work with an excuse and he went there. And a police officer actually thought that he's a fellow Eshtebe, until he started to really join the people in the prayer and so on. So then he was also, so they were beaten and ice water was poured over them. So there were like these water cannons. And you can imagine March in Slovakia is a cold day. So this icy cold water on the people and this beating. So
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
He came and I saw him and it was water pouring from him. And I was confused. I didn't know. I knew something is happening, to be honest, Ian, because my primary school was situated next to the police headquarters in the center of Bratislava. And I saw so many police officers and the army gathering in the yard, because our primary school had several floors and I was on the third floor. So I could really see them gathering with all the, you know, with the batons and the shields and stuff. And I was like, I have never seen something like that before. And I was shocked. But then our mother picked us up. My sister and I were in the same primary school. And we were at the reception of the offices of a construction company. And that evening, the communists chose the best program for the destruction. So there was this romance of the beautiful Angelique. It was a huge hit that time. And we were watching this movie at the reception and my father was on the street, you know, they were beaten and we were there. It was... Yeah. But my mom, this is an important thing to say. My mom had a discussion with my father, I learned later in life, because she wanted to go there. She wanted to go there, but my father said to her, when something happens, it happens only to one of us, and then the other can take care of the children.
Wow.
So this was their conversation, but my mom still couldn't stay calm So she ran into one of the offices in the building and she called the police. She called the police and she said, during the phone call, this is what she said. Are you really beating your mothers, brothers, sisters, fathers, and friends? Is this who you are? Shame on you. Shame on you. Then she hung up.
Wow.
And the following days, there was a huge investigation because they somehow tracked it. And the police came into the offices and they investigated and they came into that office and so on. My mom was investigated. She didn't say anything, of course, there was fear, but they didn't find out. They didn't find out what she did.
Wow. That's an incredible story. I'm sort of amused by the government putting on a good TV program to try and stop people demonstrating. I find that a really interesting tactic is that they, you know, they bring out some blockbuster film that they know people want to watch to stop them going out on the streets. That's a really, really interesting. So as 1988 goes into 1989, you're 14 at that point?
Not even that.
Not even
I was born 1976. And during the Velvet Revolution, you know, it was it started on the 17th of November. So the demonstration started in Prague. And then they continued it under cities. And in Bratislava, it was end November until end December, where all the demonstrations, the Velvet Revolution demonstration. So I had my birthday during those times, you know. So while I myself was on the street, you know, protesting, because I knew already back then that what is happening to us, it's not good. It's not just we were oppressed and we were poor and it was bad, and I knew that. So I wasn't just a 12-year-old child, not a 13-year-old, who is dragged by her mother to be there. I knew to an extent why I'm there, and I felt proud. I feel proud to this day that I'm a part of something important, although. When you are a child and everyone around you is taller than you and so many people, thousands and thousands of people, and it's cold and it's snowing and there are minus degrees and all this huge crowd and the fear, you know. So I am glad that I experienced that all. But on the other hand, I think it did contribute to my post-trauma stress disorder, because it was also so confusing for me to, this fear, this not being able to be myself, to be more or less somebody else at home with my family, and to behave differently and at the school, and always be careful what I say and what I don't say. And then at such a young age, on the street demonstrating, singing revolutionary songs. We had our songs. And some of the most famous were written by the very famous Karel Kryl. So sing those songs and jingle my mom's keys and being there. I will never forget that. You know, it's such a strong memory.
No, I can I can imagine how powerful that would have been for you. And particularly seeing your parents demonstrating like that, and the, you know, you very eloquently described the fear that there was amongst people in Czechoslovakia during that period of standing out and of protesting, and to then be on the streets actively protesting and singing those songs must have been an incredible experience. It's interesting what you were saying there about the trauma, because I think it's something that people probably don't recognize, is that you were having to live a split personality. You had like a public facing image of normality and being faithful to the party and a member of the Young Pioneers. Yet at home, you were completely different. You know, you were part of a Catholic family, and, you know, that there was a completely different person there that you weren't allowed to exhibit even to your closest friends. I presume your closest friends had no idea that you were of the Catholic faith.
Yeah, some of my friends had parents who were communists, so yes, school friends. Yeah, it was difficult because it was not just just being a Christian, but for me, I was always somebody who believed in God or in a higher force, however we name him, her today, you know. So I always felt that there is a higher meaning and a higher purpose, and I had that strong longing to learn more, and I would say the emotional problem started very early in life. So I was about 12 years old, where I regularly cried myself to sleep. So I cried late in the evening until I couldn't anymore. Alone in bed with my sister. We had a bunk. Do you say bunk bed?
Yeah, bunk bed.
So she was on the top floor, the top of the bed, and I was down there, and I was crying, and sometimes she was crying too. So it was difficult. It was difficult because I was always a very emotional person. I would say a hypersensitive person. I started to write poems at the age of, 10, 12. I wrote many observations into diaries. And it wasn't observations like, I like that boy, I hope he likes me one day. It was more really like observations and questions and not understanding and trying to understand and finding a meaning. And so I started to write very early in life, and I had many, many travel diaries and many diaries. I was always writing, because I was so shy and so emotional, and I couldn't verbalize it. So I couldn't say it, you know, so mostly without crying. So I was that emotional. So you can imagine that. Yeah. My like depression or emotional issue started when I was 12, 13, I would say, because all of that confusion I had such a strong emotional world. I was just like, you know, I saw a tree and I could look at the tree for hours because it was so fascinating to me, the trunk and touching the trunk. And I was really a little weirdo because I obsessed about things, and I loved the nature. And to this day, I love the nature. I have even some friends who met me because I was standing in a park looking at a tree, and they joined me and asked me, what do you see there? Like the tree. So this is the type of person I am, and I have hundreds of photos of nature. So I was always very sensitive and even hypersensitive. So the tension already at home between my parents and then towards us. I couldn't cope with it. I couldn't cope with it at all. So I was like, that was my escape. The nature was my escape. Writing was my escape, and reading. Many, many, many books. Yeah. And one day I wrote my own.
And very excellent book it is. And that's what I was going to say. I mean, your honesty about your experiences and the mental challenges that you went through are very raw and honest in the book. And that's what I found really powerful and moving, is that you weren't sort of glossing over stuff. You were telling it as it was and how you experienced it. And I was going to say, see the emotion within the words. And that really did, you know, it's rare a book moves me like that. And this book did in certain places. Made me laugh, made me cry. I mean, you know, what more could you ask from a book? I mean, it had that effect on me.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate that. I would like to say that some people I never met contacted me after they read my book, and it was many people. And today, to this day, there are still people contacting me who face mental health related challenges, who struggle, and many people opened themselves for the first time. Even I was surprised. I mean, I know my intention why I wrote this book, and you said it. You said it is, I wanted to share honestly. I wanted to remove myself from the position of somebody who lives in guilt and shame and with many secrets and injuries. And people contact me and they share for the first time, I would really like to speak with you. So for me, that's very special. That's very special. It's really honest interest. It's actually trying to start a journey to healing. And I feel that. I feel that, and I really appreciate that when people contact me and they share so honestly. So this is a great thing after I publish my book, that people.
It is. And it's great that you have that interaction with people and you're able to help people through the book and through your, you know, your advocacy around mental health as well. I had a couple of other questions.
Yes.
When did you first visit Austria?
So it was early 90s. It was in spring. It was a spring day, because I remember it was really, the weather was really nice, and we were allowed to finally, you know, visit our neighbors, and it was a sunny day, and I remember it quite clearly, because we went, the whole family, and we took equipment with us, and you will understand why I'm saying that, because we wanted to have a small piece of the barbed wire. So we had our equipment, and when we were at the border, we cut, I think, 3-4 pieces of the barbed wire to keep. So memory.
As a souvenir.
Yeah. Souvenir for us, but the terrible, terrible place where many people died. So we basically went for a very, very long walk, and we walked and walked. So we left Bratislava, and then there was a long journey until we crossed the Danube River, and then we walked and walked, and we ended in a small town called Hainburg. Hainburg an der Donau, to say it, to say the whole name. And we were so confused. We were very confused because everything was so different and so beautiful. You know, there were houses, family houses, huge. They looked like villas, but they were like regular family houses for them. And they had flowers and gardens, and every family had like two cars, beautiful cars, not just one. And it wasn't a Trabant or Skoda or Wartburg, you know, it was a Lada. It was, you name it, you know. There was such beautiful, shiny cars. So, you know, when you see something and it is so beautiful, you feel like your eyeballs are going to fall out, you know. So we were so shocked. It was such a shock to see so much beauty. And people were friendly, so they knew we are coming. But so they were friendly on the street. We didn't understand much because the dialect is again different than from the German we were learning at school, because this was like, you know, the Eastern Germany. So that German we learned was a different German from the street German in a small Austrian town. So we didn't understand much, but they were friendly. They were friendly, but to see so much wealth, you know, and all those beautiful buildings and cars, I couldn't believe my eyes, really. And all my family, we just, you know, we were happy for them because we were not somebody who was jealous, but at the same time we felt this injustice, you know, like not having anything and working so hard and not having, and then all of a sudden seeing those family houses with two cars and understanding that there is a different life is possible. And we had that different life than after the Velvet Revolution, because both of my parents were successful at their work, and they in top management and in mechanical engineering and then in statistics, high positions where they were sending reports to the Eurostat after Slovakia joined the European Union. So my father was responsible for the Eurostat stats, so statistics. So, and my mom was deputy director at a company. So they achieved very high position once they were free, you know, to be themselves and being able to breathe. They made career. They built a house next to Bratislava. We have to this day. It's a beautiful big house. And we have a Volkswagen, you know, a newer car. And we have a vineyard and a beautiful garden. As I said, my mom, unfortunately, she died last year. So, but she enjoyed these things for years, and it was good. I was very glad and to see and that my parents could experience something else and really having, you know, to have the good things and not just working hard and a lot, but also having the harvest, the fruit of your labor, you know.
And we have further photos, videos and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War Conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Thanks again to all our financial supporters of the podcast, but a special thanks to our Politburo level Patreons, who are Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, and Jeffrey Jones, who are supporting us at $30 per month. Thank you. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.